Welcome to Human Risk, a podcast dedicated to the understanding of human behaviour as a risk. Here's your host, Christian Hunt.
Hello and welcome back to the Human Risk podcast. On this episode, I'm looking at communication and in particular, the art and science of doing it effectively. My guest, Mark Ross, is a communication strategist who helps businesses and politicians to get their message across. In a world where we're all being bombarded with messages, I thought it would be interesting to explore how those messages are crafted and what goes into an effective communication strategy. In our discussion, we explore Mark's experience in helping politicians on the campaign trail. He tells me which ones he thinks are good at communicating and which ones need a bit of help. How has communication shaped the war in Ukraine? What are the ways in which people who aren't natural-born communicators can get their message across? As Mark explains, it's no good if you're a politician with great ideas, but you can't get elected to implement them. To be elected, you need to be able to communicate. We also talk about companies and some of the differences between the way politicians and corporate leaders communicate. You'll learn why sometimes the art of the communication strategist is to keep things out of the news, and whether spin doctors deserve the reputation they have. You'll also hear about Mark's podcast and get insights into how social media has impacted communication strategy. Unsurprisingly, Mark is a great communicator and a lot of fun to speak to. Before we begin, your usual reminder that my new book, Humanizing Rules, Bringing Behavioral Science to Ethics and Compliance, is available for pre-order now. There's a link to that in the show notes. With that said, let's get on with the show and my conversation with Mark Ross on communication strategy. Mark, welcome to the Human Risk Podcast.
Wonderful being here. Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you. It's always fun to talk transatlantic in this world of, I love it.
I love talking to you, so this is going to be a lot of fun. Now, I know who you are, but many of my listeners may not have heard of Mark Ross. They will have done by the end of the show, but to kick us off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So the quick answer is, yeah, I do geopolitical business communications, which doesn't really mean anything too crazy, other than what I try to do is understand what's happening in the world, help really smart people communicate to various audiences. My background has always been at the intersection of kind of campaigns, political campaigns, and business. I worked on several presidential campaigns. I did some work for the Tory Party back when William Hague was at the top of the ticket against Blair, which was an interesting experience. And I worked on the Microsoft antitrust case and basically had all these skills that we learned on the campaign trail and then would apply to kind of classic communications, public affairs, and lobbying. Most recently, I'd say the last decade, I've been really spending time focused on the U.S.-China commercial relationship, which is super interesting. But once again, it's really taking those skills learned on the campaign trail and take very complex issues and find ways to communicate to different audiences. I have this theory about communications high-low. So it's super important to spend time in Davos, talk to CNBC, you know, speak to BBC, get interviewed by the Financial Times. But it's equally important to be able to drop in St. Louis, Missouri, and talk to a local chamber of commerce and connect with people in different ways. The media environment now is such that it's very high low, right? I mean, you have like professional news broadcasters telling the same story that's being told on TikTok. So from a communication strategy standpoint, it's super interesting. It's super challenging. It's super fun. Most of my clients find it, the world, pretty daunting. It used to be a lot easier 40 years ago when you could just speak to the New York Times and be done with it. But now we have a whole new environment.
And I was going to say, I mean, it's a skill. If you look at your back, you talked about political campaigns. And go back then, it was kind of like the preserver. You know, if you're a politician, you need to be able to communicate. But it's something that is almost a skill that everybody needs to have on some level because we're all having to communicate in different ways. There's this idea about personal branding. And we all have opportunities to broadcast. So the skills that you're talking about that were sort of requirements for specific roles, it seems to me are requirements for everybody these days on some level.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm biased. I think communications is super important, but no, Christian, I totally agree. I think at the end of the day, humans want to hear stories. We want to connect. We're just hardwired to accept information and the ability to tell it in interesting, compelling, entertaining, educating ways is super important. Whether you're a doctor, whether you're launching a startup, you know, whether you're an astronaut trying to convince Congress that you need more money to send a spacecraft to Mars, you got to be able to tell your story and communicate. And then the ability to like be a chameleon and have different skill sets when you're talking to the board of directors at Goldman Sachs versus, like I said, like you're in San Diego and you're talking to some startup founders, the same message can be told to those two different audiences, but the way you convey that story and the way you connect can be totally different. And I think communications is a superpower. To me, it's like one of the best skills you can possibly have. You could have the smartest idea in the world. You could have a way to solve climate change. But if you can't tell that story and convince enough people, you're not going to be able to get it done. And, you know, I tell people, look at comedians. You want to get better at telling at communications? Just watch a lot of comedians. I tell people to go to improv classes. Just get comfortable with the spoken word and it'll go a long way.
And I love that, by the way. I love because I think you're absolutely right. It's like, who's good at communicating, resonate? Find people that can get an audience and get something across to them and engage them. And you've got some, it might not be valid in all situations. You don't necessarily want to be doing that at a funeral, for example, but you know, at least you'll pick up some techniques. But the thing I find interesting about it is that communication is obviously something that we're born with the ability, and then we learn languages and skills. But what's interesting is the reason that people like you have to exist is that clearly we can screw it up, right? That there are, so this natural ability, on the face of it, we can all talk, you know, and we have basic sort of cognitive abilities. And yet, we see lots of examples of high profile people screwing it up. We know when it goes wrong and we know when it goes really well. And so the reason that you sort of, not the reason you exist, Mark Ross, but the reason that your role exists is that there's an art to it, right? If you haven't learned it, you can mess it up. And I'm intrigued by that idea that on the one hand, it's a skill we naturally have. You know, it's not something like driving a vehicle that you need to learn that we don't come built with. On the other hand, we have to take it to a whole new level. And so that basic skill that we're born with isn't necessarily enough. And that's why we need people like
Well, yeah, and I think there's a lot of smart, interesting people that are like subject matter experts, and they're really comfortable kind of talking to each other. Like, I think the big thing here in DC is you got a lot of think tank people. They just talk to other think tank people. You know, that's super easy. Or I think about like the Liz Truss experience. You know, Liz Truss had a 6-week campaign. She was only talking to the most, you know, headbanger Tory party members. Everything she said was well received. But when she got into number 10, she had to talk to like not only the UK, but the entire world. Right. And that skill set didn't work. Right. That skill set of talking to Tory members is one thing, but her ability then to communicate to these different audiences failed. And I think that's like this idea of like being a chameleon, being flexible, really understanding the context. I mean, you're spot on about a funeral, right? Your behavior at a funeral is different than a wedding. You can tell a story at a wedding about your best mate, right? And maybe it's more joyful. And you can tell a story about your best mates at a funeral. Maybe it's a bit more sober, but your context is super important. Understand the audience and never stopping. I think one of the interesting things about trust is that, and this happens to a lot of politicians, they win an election, they get the big job, they walk in the big office, they're sitting behind the desk and they're like, oh, our work is done. In fact, your work has just started. You know, all you did is won an election. You got to keep on campaigning. And if you look at like with Zelensky, Ukraine, we're coming up with a 1-year anniversary. I mean, he's a communication machine. That guy is out every day. His wife is out there. They're using all kinds of different formats, high, low, and he hasn't stopped. And, you know, credit to him and what he's trying to accomplish. But that's another kind of example. I think if you look at just the most recent stuff, I think about trust in Zelensky, and you can see why Zelensky's still in power and trust is, you know, on the book circuit.
And I want to come up to Zelensky, because I think it's a really interesting example. But just picking Truss and Johnson as a contrast, right, to her predecessor. One of the things I find interesting is that he's a very good communicator. And you could say the same thing about Trump. And yet, if you look at what they actually say, you write it down, it's often sort of illiterate and rambling and doesn't work. And I'm conscious now that I'm being illiterate and rambling, but hopefully communicating well. But it doesn't sort of make sense. It's not a logical process. And yet it does engage people. And trust, if you wrote down some of the things she said, much more robotic. And so this isn't a logical exercise, right? It's a really emotional exercise. It's not a sort of logical mathematical skill, if I can put it in those terms.
That's 100%. I mean, there's definitely a science to it, like the hero's journey. I mean, obviously alliteration, you know, being able to write, communicate, use various technology. But there's also an art to it, right? And getting back to that idea about comedians, you're right. I mean, they got to walk on a stage and within seconds, they've got to win over an audience that doesn't know anything about them. So that's kind of an interesting skill. And that comes from a lot of repetition, right? I think about the Beatles started in Liverpool, but they really got their beat in Hamburg, right? Where they just played constantly, any venue, anytime. And there's something about getting in the repetition, right? Ridley Scott, famous actor or director, he shot, I don't know, close to, you know, he shot many, many 20,000 different commercials over the course of his lifetime. And it wasn't until he perfected that skill that he was ready to be a director. So there's something about like this idea of going to Hamburg, getting in the reps, getting in the practice. Also, I've got this example, Christian, of like a 2x2 box, which, you know, every consultant, every, you know, has to have, every MBA class has to have a 2x2. And essentially the the best politicians are in the upper right corner, right? And I call them the popes. And this came for me from Obama, who was speaking to Bernie Sanders. I'm not sure if you know Bernie Sanders. He's a senator from Vermont, you know, great guy, but, you know, he's definitely left the mainstream, socialist, you know, the whole deal. Has some great ideas, but Bernie's never going to become president, right? Now he's going to influence and shape. And Obama, there's a quote, basically he says, you know, Bernie, you're an Old Testament prophet. You know, you're kind of like leading and like stirring up the debate, showing the party where you can go. But Obama's basically saying to Bernie, at the end of the day, the president's got to make decisions, right? And I think about this idea of like the Pope, right? Obama, I would even say like a Tony Blair, like they kind of get into that space. Whereas like the prince is more like a Boris Johnson. He's super popular, but he doesn't have like the polish and the skill of a Tony Blair to kind of execute, right? And I think about Rishi Sunak, Hillary Clinton, Mitt Romney, super smart, know the policy, but don't have like communication skills to really push them to like the next limit. And I think, which is fine. I think part of it too, as a communicator or giving advice to people is kind of knowing your skill sets and being comfortable with that. And then finding platforms where you can succeed. You know, sure, everybody'd like to be Obamas, but you know, there's only a handful of Obamas. Blair, Clinton, these guys are just like otherworldly. So how do you succeed if you're Theresa May? And I think that's like a lesson a lot of executives don't want to hear, but sometimes you got to be like, listen, this is where you're really good. And we're going to concentrate your efforts on these three or four platforms.
Just do it. So your 2x2 matrix, just remind us of those four bits, because I think I only caught three of them.
Yeah. So the 2x2 matrix is based on professionalism, right? This way, and then popularity, right? So to win number 10 of the White House, you've got to be both professional and popular, right? I mean, ultimately, our system is set up, you have to win elections to set policy, right? So without that, you can have all the great ideas in the world, but if you can't convince enough people, you're not going to win the election. So in the upper right corner is this idea of like the Pope. So the Pope, you know, I think I'm a Catholic, so I kind of think about like, listen, like this institution's been around for, you know, 2,000 plus years and it moves set of lumbering, but it's got to like kind of make decisions and kind of protect the institution. Whereas like a priest, I would say like a Rishi Sunak, smart guy, interesting, knows the policy, you know, can tell you everything about the Bank of England, you know, but does he have the skill and the wherewithal to communicate and kind of lead? And then the other one is like the prince, which I would say is like a Boris Johnson, kind of below the Pope. Definitely popular, but doesn't really have the professional skills, the discipline, or to kind of get it done. Like, I mean, Johnson could probably win 7 out of 10 elections, right? Now, is he a good prime minister? You know, maybe not, right? And then the other one is like the prophet. So these would be like a Farage, a Bernie Sanders, an AOC. Like their ideas get a lot of attention, a lot of energy, but it's unlikely that Farage is ever going to get into number 10. But he does shape what happens in number 10, but he doesn't have that full skill set. He's not as popular and he's not as professional. And ultimately, I think the best executives, like think about like Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase, right? He would be in that Pope category, right? Great communicator, makes tough decisions. Or some CEOs, you never want to be popular and not professional. You know, you want to be both popular and professional.
I love that. That's really, really interesting. And so you're basically looking at that model and then saying, okay, wherever you are, stick to your core skill set in that space. So it's implicitly a transition across that is difficult. I'm probably presuming not impossible, but quite challenging. And so you're really saying, if we looked at that, we'd identify where one sat on that. And then you just push that those particular buttons in that space that you're good at.
Correct. And you could also flip it around the other way too. Like if you're trying to influence or be a communicator, recognize where people are in that 2x2 matrix. You know, where's DBC versus the Financial Times? What's the LBC, Let Britain Chat? Or, you know, where's DW versus AFP versus the Financial Times? Like they all fit in different matrices too, right? So if Steve Bannon says something to me, you know, on his podcast, like, you know, my politician's crazy, that's one thing. But if, you know, the New York Times says it carries a different weight. So there's also that idea too of knowing yourself, where you fit as a communicator, or even like people you're working with or audiences you're trying to influence, but also media organizations. When I enter, like when I think like strategically, when I'm thinking, like basically I do three things. I try to provide geopolitical intelligence, right? Just here's what's happening in the world with no bias. Like, you know, I've got my own opinion on stuff, but as a strategist, it doesn't really matter. Like, here's what's happening. Like, these are popular, this, not popular, like, this is what people are thinking, right? So you got to really know, like, what's happening and then sort out the strategy, like, how we're going to, like, win. And then the final framework is, I call the twin framework, TWIN. So what's the target? And then usually, on a big complex issue, there's going to be 7 to 9 audiences that you got to engage with. And the win, like out of that, so like out of those audiences, the W is like, which audiences do we have to win, right? Which audiences do we have to influence? And then the N would be, which audiences do we have to neutralize? If you shape like a political campaign or even a business rollout, if you're launching a new product, whatever it is, like there's going to be groups that are automatically going to hate you, right? So you got to figure out like how we're going to neutralize them, what groups we have to influence, then what groups do we 100% have to win? And the twin model works out really well. And that could be everything from a book launch, even like a, you know, climate change kind of situation. But that's part of it too. Like, so I think that's where maybe the science comes into it. That's kind of twin framework. But the art then is like, okay, we've identified this group that we have to win. What are the tools we're going to use to make sure they stay with us? And that's where maybe the art comes into play.
Wow. I love that. Cause on the face of it, it's sort of like, we just have to get a message across, but it's really interesting when you start to dissect it and go, okay, well, what is that, you know, how is that best going to be transmitted, i.e. what are your skill sets? And then you sort of go, what is it trying to land with the audience? And I love that idea of thinking about people that we just want to neutralize, right? We're never going to turn them. And I think it's been really interesting for people, so, you know, individuals on social media, you sort of see people having arguments.
Right.
Kind of like, there's a pointless argument, right? Because it's that old adage about the having wrestling with a pig, right? You're going to get messy and the pig's going to enjoy it.
Right.
Right? And so I think that's a really interesting idea that you're sort of going, we recognize we have to do something about it, but it's a case of neutralizing and not trying to convert it.
Yeah. So like, I think about like, I mean, US-China relationship or Germany-China relationship or EU-China. I mean, the China's like, you know, interesting. It's a kind of human rights problems, you know, competition. They want to take over Taiwan someday, but it's also a huge market. So I think about like Scholz. You know, he was the first EU leader to visit Xi after his third term. And he took a business delegation with him, you know, including folks at BASF who are building a huge plant there. And, you know, I mean, Germany's connection to China economically is super, super important, right? So you think about it from a communication standpoint, Scholz and his team are never going to win over everybody, or even in the reporting from Reuters, FT, DW, et cetera. So they got to be like, listen, like, we're not going to win this debate, whether this is good or bad, but we need to neutralize this and be a part of these stories, right? I think as a communication strategist, you think about, like I said, like we definitely need this newspaper, these influencers, these elected officials to speak positively about us. But if we're going to be in a story in the Financial Times, let's make sure it's like neutral, that we didn't give up ground or we didn't lose ground. And sometimes that's good enough in communications, right? It takes a little bit of like gumption and strategy to be like, hey boss, like this article, that can be great, but it could be worse if we're not in it. So like, at least let's give our side of the story and go from there, because we've neutralized it, right? But by the way, we're going to combat this bad story with these other publications or this kind of media effort in the next few weeks.
That's just, there's so many things in that, because it's, no, because on the face of it, it's sort of like, make sure the message lands well will be the sort of basic task. But actually what you're saying is, in some cases, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't have to land well, it just has to land, right? You have to be there. And so I'm intrigued about some of these. So I mean, a lot of these techniques, it's when you explain the way you just have, it makes perfect sense, right? But it feels counterintuitive. And many of the things you've described there, again, it's back to that going against the natural grain of the way we might think to do things. And hence, sort of do-it-yourself communications, you know, isn't going to, from what you're saying, isn't going to cut. And again, yeah, of course you're talking from position of vested interest, but it makes perfect sense, right? We need to think really carefully about who we're communicating with, why we can, and how, all of those things, if we want to be successful at getting our message across.
Yeah, this actually gets back to like my campaign experience, right? Like, you know, to win a campaign, all you need is 50% plus one, right? I don't need 100% of the voters. I don't need 75%. In fact, I just need, if that 50% plus one other person, and I win the election. Whether I win the election by 10,000 votes or one vote, I won the election. So when you go, literally, this is where the science comes into it. Like, if you step back and do the mathematics, just spend time with like campaign pros. And it's interesting what the BBC does about the swing, the pendulum and all this stuff, or the number of votes, right? There's a mathematical formula. I mean, either people vote or they don't vote. And going into an election, you could figure out, listen, for me to win this constituency, for me to be an MP for this district, I'm going to need 25,000 votes, right? And then you build out your coalition. Like, what groups do I need to win? What groups do I need to influence? What groups do I need to neutralize that are going to get me to that 25,000? And that's where you kind of think about like communication, especially at a very high level. If you're JP Morgan Chase, Bank of England, Ford Motor Company, I mean, there are people that just cover Ford Motor Company, all that. And a beat reporter is different than a columnist, and it's different than a blogger. And understanding that is part of the game too. But the mathematics and the science of it can be kind of interesting. And a lot of times communications, it's a bit of a long game, right? Short of a book launch or a new product launch, most efforts are going to be kind of multi-year. So it gives you some time too. But yeah, I just look at like, we're never going to win everybody. So who do we definitely need to own? Who's got to be part of our team? And then, you know, where can we neutralize? If somebody says something bad about us, great. Like, one of my big things, I was the communications director of the US China Business Council. Like, I was mad when we weren't in stories, right? Because I was like, why didn't the reporter call us and just give us a chance? But then it also gives you an opportunity to go back to that reporter and say, hey, you know, like, we also have a position on this, you know, it may be different than what you've read or heard, or we're happy to educate you. And that's part of it. But that takes like a long-term kind of thinking, right?
You mentioned Zelensky, and I absolutely want to come back to it because there's, as you, you know, I look at it as a sort of just as a, and clearly I am a target audience on some level, probably a part of public opinion in Western Europe.
100%.
Yeah. But he's got a ton of other ones. He seems to me to be doing a phenomenal job, and that he seems to be very good at, because what I think is really interesting is you can see nowadays the different audiences. You know, in the old days, I might just have been able to see what's me, but if I'm, providing I'm willing to watch different channels or read different newspapers, I can see how he's doing that. And as I look at it, it's phenomenal what he's achieved. I mean, have you been surprised by that? Is this an absolute masterclass in the making, or is this just something that other people do and I just happen to focus on it because he's in the public eye a lot, given the story?
No, it's unprecedented. I've been like totally blown away. Like, three things like I've been blown away by. He's consistent, like him and his team every day. So like I watch Sky News on 5 o'clock, so 10 o'clock, right? I watch at 10 o'clock. And is it Kay Burley? Is that Kay, what's her name, the reporter?
Kay Burley, yeah.
Yeah, she's in Ukraine last night with the First Lady of Ukraine. They're surrounded by tanks, but the Ukrainian First Lady is like an amazing red coat, high fashion, surrounded by all this detritus of war. But, you know, so a Sky News report. And then I think about Zelensky comes to D.C. He doesn't wear a suit and tie to go to the House of Representatives to speak to Congress. He's wearing, you know, olive green camo. He's beaming into Davos, right? He's like giving up interviews. He's talking to Sean Penn. He's talking, you know, so he's like, he's all over. And he's like, but the discipline is like super interesting. I mean, every day is like, there's definitely a committed effort. But like every day we're going to communicate. And then this high-low approach. Some days I'm going to be on the floor of Congress. Some days I'm going to speak to Sky News. Some days I'm going to do a radio broadcast. But this war, to me, it's a lot. Obviously the military stuff is super important, but him keeping this story front page, saying this is a worthy effort, make the investment, is heavily dependent on communications, because they're like totally under resourced, under in every category, right? But one of the things he's got better than anybody, getting back into like, you know, square box, like what's his biggest asset is like his ability to tell a story. You know, Putin is never going to get a vote cover. You know, he's never going to get invited to the House of Representatives. You know, Boris Johnson was just in Ukraine, like that coverage. So like that's like their superpower. And they decided to make a big effort on that. But I think the consistency and the discipline is something you shouldn't discount. I mean, it's easy to talk and tell your story, but every day he's getting up, him and his team, and they're telling the story. And discipline and consistency is a huge tactical thing that shouldn't be underestimated.
And have you seen this shift? I mean, is your sense that there was a playbook before the war, or that they're developing it as they go?
No, I think his instincts as an actor, right? Getting back to this idea about being a comedian, entertainment, like being comfortable in front of the camera, him realizing Listen, my skill set is like, I'm totally comfortable in front of a camera. I can connect with people, right? So I think he realized that was the tool that we're going to employ. Now, if, you know, I don't want to pick on Liz Truss, but let's say Liz Truss was running Ukraine. She doesn't really have that skill set, right? So she would probably have to rely on different things to get her out. But I think Zelensky, coming from this idea of being comfortable on camera, is super important. That's why I encourage, like I said, like I've talked about this before, but the comedian aspect or doing improv or, you know, just doing this, like just getting on a camera, talking to different people, it goes a long way. Nobody really likes to be on camera, but, you know, at a certain point, if you have ideas, you're going to have to like talk to different folks. And I think, I'm guessing Zelensky was like, this is going to be one of our tools. And it's going to be studied for sure. We're coming up with the 1 year anniversary. There's going to be all kinds of analysis around the comms. But for me, it's when Zelensky and his wife were on the cover of Vogue magazine and they sent Annie Leibovitz to shoot the photos. I was like, this is a whole different level of like communications.
Because it's not like if you look at the sort of wartime leader playbook, I mean, I would point to sort of Churchill,
a good example,
sort of classic one you'd roll out. This, in some respects, I could say it's a 21st century version of that. Different scenario, different. But as you say, he seems to have captured, there's a lot of sort of 21st century tech. There's technology, there's techniques, there's, it's like, as you say, just a totally different game. For me, it's just been astonishing to watch the level of sophistication from a government, because I might expect that from a corporation, but governments we typically associate with being clunky, and not, and so all of that has been quite astonishing, I think, both what they've done, but also who's doing.
But I do think the Ukrainians have had, there's no doubt they've had a lot of help from the French, from the Brits, from the US, like a lot. It's like, right? I mean, a lot. That's like going under the radar, right? Obviously, but all our special forces, all our best intelligence people are in that part of the world. But rightly, they've said, listen, Zelensky is front and center, right? I mean, Macron's taking a back seat, Biden's taking a back seat. Even, you know, the UK prime minister is like, Zelensky's been the front person, which I think is a huge credit. And I think there's a lot of smart, interesting people that are working on this. Like, I can't wait, obviously, for this conflict to end, but I can't wait for 5 years or 10 years when we get like the real story. Because from a comms perspective, yeah, I mean, this is like, I hate to see what's happening, but it's been absolutely fascinating to watch.
And is there anything that you would say that they could improve on?
Anything they could improve on? You know, it's a little, I don't know. The fatigue stuff's a little interesting. Like always being in the olive green. I don't know. Sometimes I think, is that, because I think a lot about presentation. I don't know. But that's like he's like so embedded now to that olive green look, like he can't get out of it. That's, I wonder if, you know, and it's early. I mean, we're only a year into this thing, and I think it's going to go on longer. So I think about that, but I think the effort has been precise. I think the other thing you could probably communicate better on is like why Ukraine should be independent, right? I mean, in many ways, to me, this reminds me of the War of 1812, so which happened 30 years after the Revolutionary War. We scrapped again with the Brits. That had a lot to do with our sovereignty, like impressing sailors and sorting out kind of North America, who's going to control it. And it was like 30 years later. And this, you know, like Ukraine has been free for 30 years. So in many ways, like this really is a fight for Ukraine's independence. And it's not surprising that it's happening 30 years later. So maybe really talking more about that, why that matters.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a slightly unfair question on the basis that this isn't a sort of like planned PR campaign. You've had a load of time to think about it. He's having to react under massive amounts of psychological pressure, time pressure, military. There's a whole load of things going on. So it's not just here's your front man recording an ad or something. He's actually having to make lots of government decisions. And clearly comms is a key part of that role now. It's not just about, you know, how do we want to run things. And I guess it's what I find interesting is that in order to be able to do the communication piece, and you can sort of see it based on what I read about his leadership, he devolves a lot of responsibility. So let's let the generals get on with the military stuff.
Yeah, it's a bit of a CEO style, right? Yeah.
Right. And I think for that struck me as being very interesting is that he wouldn't have the skill set to be hands-on with a lot of those things anyway. And therefore, he's really focusing and doing what he's good at and has turned that into the role. And so, he's the communication. I mean, in many respects, right, communications is the job.
Right, 100%, yeah. I think my guess with the tank situation getting sorted out, I mean, that's a bit of propaganda from the West as well, telling Putin, hey, man, like, we're committed to this, you know, we're going to send more kit and more stuff to that part of the region. Is really how this ends. As you know, most wars have always ended by people getting together and redrawing the map. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on saying, listen, man, you know, 20% is going to go to Russia. You're going to have your sovereignty. And, but that's a tough story to sell because, you know, what's interesting about Zelensky and any world leader, you know, they also have domestic audience. There's foreign audiences, but they also have domestic audiences. Right. And, that's why I think this idea of like why Ukraine should be independent, why it's worth getting back Crimea, that's going to be like the next big communication battle.
Fascinating stuff. And as you say, like it's relentless. And so there's, I guess in the same way as the war, right? There's no break in that PR campaign. And it's interesting actually when we talk about the language we use for communication, we often use the language of war. If I think about, you know, the word campaign, for example, is a good example of that. It's an ongoing challenge in many respects. And I thought your comment earlier about, you know, you've got to think long-term about these things is interesting because if coming at it fresh from the outside is you sort of look at it and go, okay, we'd run an advertising campaign, but things like branding, you have to be thinking much more long-term and much more challenges. And so it strikes me that in the work that you do, you've got, on the one hand, you've got the sort of firefighting. On the other hand, you've got that longer term brand perspective. And so I'm assuming you've got to be thinking about both, but some of the skills that you might need to firefight can be very different to that long-term brand building.
Yeah, I think, and recently I've seen a lot of companies, there's been so much more cultural discussion about what's happening in the world, and there's more causes, and you know, there's the idea that consumers want the brands they associate with to be more kind of woke or more aware of what's happening. And, you know, you'll see from time to time, companies will just suddenly jump on a bandwagon and say, we're committed to doing X, Y, and Z, where, you know, never once in their 50-year history have they ever said they're interested in that topic. And I think that kind of short-term distraction, media pressure is kind of foolish.
But very tempting, right?
Very tempting because it's like comfortable, like we're all on the same page, like we're fighting this, like, and there's so much peer pressure. Like right now, there's been a lot of talk about why are all these layoffs happening, right? Are they happening because they have to happen? Or are they happening because other boards and CEOs are looking around and saying, well, you know, if Johnny and Sally are laying off people, I should lay off people. So we're very tribal and very human. And like, yeah, it's like, as she talks about, it's very tough to go against the grain, to be contrarian. You know, we're, as you know, rightly know, it's very comfortable being in numbers and kind of going on the pack. And, but do you really need to have an earth, you know, let's just pick on the earth, you know, Earth Day is coming up, I think in April, but you know, if you've never said anything about Earth Day over 50 years, and you suddenly say something about Earth Day, what is that about? Or how's that going to carry on? Like, how are you going to do that for like the next 50 years? You know, yeah, it may feel comfortable, it may feel good, but, and where does that get you? And I think thinking long-term, most brands at a certain point, you know, especially if they're well-established, like a Coca-Cola will probably exist longer than the Chinese Communist Party, right? So Coke, their main job is like, yes, perpetuating this thing. Right. Whereas the Communist Party got to get up every day and figure out a way to stay in power. Right. But Coke has probably already kind of won that. So they have a kind of different mission. But this idea of kind of jumping on issues, I find that kind of problematic. And, but those are tough conversations to have to tell people, like, yeah, this may feel good, but, you know, are you going to keep on doing this? Like, are you going to keep on supporting, Women's Month or, you know, whatever the latest cause is, like Earth Day, for example, like, are you going to keep on pushing that? And here's another thing about communications. This is a small example. I had a client come to me and he said, I want to write a blog a week. So he wants to write 50 blogs. Okay. I was like, great. My second question was, have you ever written a blog? He said, no. So I was like, okay. Does your audience want a blog from you? I have no idea.
It's a great question.
Right. So I'm just asking these questions. I was like, okay, we could do this, but like for you to write a blog, let's think about the organizational standpoint, right? It's going to take, say, 60 to 90 minutes for you to write this thing, right? And then who else on the team is going to edit it? you know, what's the process? Who's going to hit send? Who's going to post it? So now we're looking at 2 or 3 hours of your team's time to do this. And then just that from the organizational standpoint, right? It's something to think about because there's a lot of tendency to like people, and you know this as a communicator yourself, like doing this, doing a book or a pod. I mean, it takes a lot of time and effort and you got to carve it out. And there's organization to it as well. It's not just like hitting record. It's like the whole process behind it. And
if only.
Yeah, exactly. So like, and the client never ended up doing the blog because I was like, not that you shouldn't do it, but do you have 2 hours in the week to set aside to do this? Because it's not, that's like a big thing. Like people want to do stuff, but then it's like, what's the organization? Here's the tactic, but oh, by the way, it's going to take this amount of time. And what's the process? And I think people kind of fail on that. That's why it's easy to like send a press release, say, we support Earth Day, but you know, what are the next steps or what part of the team or what kind of resources are you going to commit to it, et cetera.
And it's kind of interesting as well, those issues. Right. You might think it's about switching your lights off for an hour, you know, once a year or whatever. But actually, once you get onto that bandwagon, logically, they've done that. So there'll be an expectation. Just on that one theme, there will be an expectation that then it's not good enough for you just to switch the lights off. Right. What else are you doing in sustainability? And you've opened this kind of channel of stuff. And if you do that for every single issue, you're almost sort of putting a target on your back in terms of, well, you've made a statement now, you better live up to that. And particularly with the transparency that's around there nowadays. So to your point, it's quite dangerous if you haven't thought it through.
And if it doesn't set a line, like if you're a local plumber or a contractor, you should want to be a good environmental steward, but is the mission of your company, does it fit? Whereas like Patagonia, you know, like a Marriott hotel chain, like, you know, this idea of corporate social responsibility is part of it, but you're spot on, Christian. Like, it's like, what's the next step and how do you keep it going? And then, oh, by the way, yeah, once you enter into this debate or this discussion, there's going to be other expectations by you internally, externally, other forces. Getting back to that, like, kind of twin model, right? Win, influence, neutralize, like, oh, now you're part of the thing. Like, what else are you going to do? So, a lot of times, like, a lot of my job is to, like, just bring reality to the situation. And because our instincts as humans is to do stuff. My job as like a strategist is to be like, here's what's happening in the world. Here's what's going to take to do this. And oh, by the way, like once you go down this path, here are the 4 or 5 other things that could potentially happen that we need to think about.
Fascinating.
And that's really like communications in many ways isn't really, we see what happens or what is said or press releases or events or book launches or interviews on CNBC, but a lot of communications is like off the radar screen, something never really happens. It's really thinking strategically about, does this make sense? You know, I mean, there's tons of stuff every company could do, but does it really matter? And does it really help? Is it really going to fix the challenge? And oh, by the way, help us, you know, stay in business.
And so in many respects, right, I guess a lot of work might be stopping things being said or stopping things being done. And therefore that's invisible. So you wouldn't see that actually, you know, they had this great idea and you've gone in and said, do not do that. Or I would recommend that you do that because and so it doesn't happen. And so I would think of your role as the speeches that go out, the ads that go out, the messaging that's going out, but actually it may be the messages that shouldn't go out.
100%. Or it's talking to a reporter and saying like, that's not the real story. Like you may think this is the story. This is the real story. This is where you should be like directing kind of media attention elsewhere. Or, there may be ideas that you want to get into the marketplace, but you don't want to have your fingers on them. So you direct, say, hey, you should go talk to, you know, Sally. She's got a really good perspective. So a lot of it is like, you know, a lot of times you'll see like vanity metrics. People will track, oh, we were in so many stories. Like, you know, we have so many hits or we got this much attention. Like sometimes, you know, I'd be super pleased if like, oh, by the way, we got no attention and we actually killed, you know, we killed 7 bad stories. You know, like you never see that kind of stuff. Or we're reshaped or re-educated or we got other people involved. That part of it too.
And how is your role shifting with things like social media? Because go back sort of 20 odd years, there is the media. And then we have this additional thing of social media and the transparency and the ability for everyone to comment. I mean, how has that changed the way you look at what you do?
I've been always very kind of like platform agnostic and just very like, I just look at them as tools, like tactics or tools. And I think people get really fascinated with different stuff and, you know, some things come and go, you know. So to me, it's just a tool. Like what are we trying to, what's the strategy? So the other model I have is this, it's called E-Stock. Like, what's the event we're trying to, what are we doing? And S is strategy, T is tactics, O is organization, K is know-how, and or C is consistency, and K is know-how. Stock, E-Stock. So strategy is like the most important thing at the end of the day, right? And then the tactics can come and go. Some days pods are better. Maybe a press conference is better. Maybe a product launch at CES is better. Maybe doing a white paper. Maybe doing a panel at Davos. Like, those are just all tactics, right? Email, social, TikTok, Facebook. I mean, so I think once you like get into that mindset, these are just tools, and not one is not better than the other. One is only better than the other depending on what you're trying to accomplish, right? There's always going to be new stuff. But if you forget about the strategy, and then getting back to that thing about the organization, like, who's actually going to do this stuff? Like, who's going to, like, you could go all in on video, but okay, who's going to shoot the video? Who's going to buy the camera? Who's going to edit it? So, you know, like, then it doesn't really matter what the tactic is if you haven't sorted out the strategy and the organization. And so I've always tried to be really platform agnostic. I think they're just tools, man. And they're just different ways to kind of tell the story. And ideally, though, you know, maybe you're using 5 or 6 different tools to do your event. I think that when you're really playing at a high level of communications, you go into an event, right? Let's just do like a product launch, and you're going to use 5 or 6 different tools. You're going to record it for audio. You're going to shoot a video. Maybe you live tweet it. Maybe it's live on Facebook. You do a blog post. You have reporters there, you know, so you've already had like 5 or 6. Those are 5 or 6 different tools. So it's not just social. I think that's where, the best communicators, they're just like, I'm going to use 5 or 6 different tools. I think a lot about like, I'm going to use everything at my disposal, right? Like, I'm a pioneer going across the plains. You know, I've just captured a buffalo. I'm going to use everything in that buffalo to help me survive.
That's
right?
A great analogy.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit colorful, a bit American maybe, but the idea is like, I really think about like, I have this piece of content. What are 5 or 6, 7, 10 other ways I can like maximize its use using different tools? I think that's the way to think about it.
And so you're monitoring the, I don't know, a new social media platform comes out. You'll be looking at it going, what can this do? But that's just another tool in the armory, and we're not going to pivot.
Exactly. I would never tell somebody to go like all in on like TikTok. I would just say, okay, TikTok's a tool, but essentially it's a short form video, which by the way, now you can do in 4 or 5 other platforms. So, if I've got the time and the resources and the energy, I would try to use 4 or 5 different tools. Like, getting back to Zelensky, like, Zelensky's on podcast, he's speaking to documentarians, he's getting photographed on Vogue, right? Those are just all tools, but he's using these different tools to tell the main message, like, Ukraine matters, this war matters, which is a strategy. That's the way to approach it. I get really hesitant when people come into me and say, oh, like that blog example, like, I want to do just a blog, like, okay. Or I'm going to go all in on LinkedIn. Or when you come in with a tactic as your solution, that's a recipe for a communications disaster. It should be like, I have this problem, or I want to achieve X. What are the best tools for me to do that? Those are the best communicators.
And it's interesting because I could sort of imagine a situation where like the TikTok one is the sort of most obvious example where you could, because the CEO's kids are on TikTok, right?
Right.
There's immediate conclusion. And that struck me that sort of thing is the danger with your field is that you've got a lot of people who think they know a lot about it, right? Because we're all communicators, we all said, so I could imagine if you were an electrician, you're less likely to have somebody turning around to go, I wouldn't do it that way, I'd do it this way. But there's a lot of sort of trying to deal with the fact that people are, a little bit of knowledge about something can be dangerous. And so one of the challenges, I guess, is that...
Yeah, I love that, Christian. You're like, yeah, the CEO is like, oh, you know, I use Facebook, or I'm on Instagram, so right. This seems easy, so let's do Instagram. Like, you're right. But if an electrician came to my house or a plumber, I would just say, here's the problem. You know, let him diagnose it, let him determine how to fix it. Or a doctor, right? Like, you know, nobody goes into the doctor and say, oh, you know, I think you should remove my lung. You know, like that tactic, like... You go in and say, I have a problem with my lung, or I'm coughing, or then you let the doctor diagnose. And I think that's where the best communication strategists really step back and say, what are you actually trying to accomplish here? And what are the best tools? And Like the books you've written, the books are great. But if like, you know, what are four or five other ways we can use that? I'm sure you're using the contents repeatedly. You're probably doing stuff now. When you step back, you're like, oh yeah, I'm actually doing some creative stuff. But it's one thing to, like a lot of policy people, they'll drop a white paper and send it to Capitol Hill and say, you know, here's how you solve the Middle East. But okay, it's a 100-page document, you know, like who has time to, you know, then some people have time to read it, but not everybody. And then getting back to the different audiences, some people do want to see you on video. Some people want to see a pod. Some people do read or written words. Some people are going to respond to the press. So as a communication strategist, you have to be very agnostic to the platforms and just say, I'm going to use these different tools to tell the story. Or I have this main piece of content, like a book. Here are four or five other ways I'm going to use this content over the next 12 months.
And I get what, I mean, this will sound very cynical, probably is slightly, but if I look
perfect,
this sort of communication and I'm not comparing you to this, but if I sort of looked at spin doctors as a sort of path, where's the balance between kind of getting a message across and the sort of the ethical considerations, if you like, in the loosest sense?
Well, I mean, Malcolm Tucker, you know, is my hero. So, Alistair Campbell. Now I think the spin doctor thing is like, it's also a bit of a myth, right? I mean, reporters and kind of give this idea like a spin doctor is going to come in and kind of save the day with a magic wand. And, you know, if I just dazzle with them with two words, that's going to kind of save it. But a lot of times, like if it's a short-term crisis, they're probably looking for times to kind of figure out what's happening. And they're put that person out there to kind of distract, delay. And that's all it really is, right? To figure out what is happening. And you can always tell the quality of the problem about who speaks first, you know. If a spin doctor speaks before like the prime minister, et cetera, there's probably more to the story, right? But I think they have a role to play because, yeah, a lot of times you may not know the full story of what's happening. But I do think there's like, there's definitely mythology, like this idea about the spin doctor. And thing is, reporters, they're very tribal. They hang out together. You know, they're all looking for stories. So they gravitate to people like spin doctors or communicators that are going to tell them stories, give them content, give them quotes. And that's kind of part of it. I mean, one of the fun things to do is you'll tell your buddies like, hey, I'm going to get interviewed on CNBC. This literally happens. And you'll say, give me a word. Let's say, you know, schnitzel, right? So you'll make like a side bet with your buddies and say, listen, if I get the word schnitzel into this interview, you know, you buy the next round of drinks or whatever. So that's part of the fun too, right? Because reporters, they're just listening or they're just reporting what's happening. So, you know, that's a fun kind of spin doctor kind of side story. But, you know, word of the day, bingo.
Right. And there's a lot of talk now about sort of, you know, about off the spin doctor, the piece of sort of dark arts, right? So you know, dead cats, right? Drop a story to try and distract. And we see, and so it's very easy to look at the news landscape and kind of be cynical about every single story that's out there, right? They're telling us this, so there must be something else. And my gut instinct is there's some certain truth to that, right? And there's clearly, there are certain TV channels, there are certain newspapers where you just read it and go, this is clearly there's a line that's being pushed here. Well, this story makes, why is this on the front page? It makes no sense whatsoever. Is it sort of as bad as my cynical brain makes out? Are we constantly manipulating, or is that still the exception?
I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, like Noam Chomsky manufacturing dissent. Like I don't think it's that bad, but you know, political communications, PM communications versus CEO communications is different, right? I mean, the PM is only in office, say 3 to 5 years. You know, and they're out. So they're working in a very kind of hothouse, aggressive environment. Whereas if you're CEO of a company, you know, the company presumably is going to be around another generation, two generations after you. So those are different kind of skill sets and different kind of communication environments. Politics now, though, it is amazing to me how much coverage it actually gets in our news cycle. I think it's like, it's almost covered like sports. There's so much more drama. You know, there's most governments, it's pretty boring stuff. You know, I mean, you've of course, you know, for various government organizations, like, you know, there's not much stuff that happens at the Fed, right? But the Federal Reserve gets covered every day. And, some, you know, they're just reading documents, trying to figure out what's going on like everybody else, but a reporter's got to say something. So that's part of it too. It's also the environment. And also I think about, all communications is not created equal. So political communications versus business communications, it's kind of a different environment. But I don't think it's as, if you're in elected office, I mean, your whole job is to like stay in the power. And you're going to do usually whatever it takes to do that. And if you've got to tell a few lies or spin the story or push it a different direction, you're probably going to do that. But it's a very short-term hyper environment.
And I think that's a really interesting, I hadn't really thought about that. That makes a bit more sense, right? Because you wouldn't be able to maintain it if you're CEO of a company spending all that effort, but you also don't need to.
No, that's exactly right. And that's why, like, I mean, campaigns are, for me, I love them because there's an end date. You know, there's an election day and that's it. Either you win or you lose, game over, right? Whereas, you know, if I'm running Kroger or Carrefour or Fiat, you know, I could have a bad quarter. I could have a bad year. Right. And still keep my job and just find more money and launch a new car if I'm Fiat. Right. But if I'm running for office, that's it. I mean, either I win or I go home. So political communications, much more heightened, much more intense. Everybody's exhausted. There's never enough time. There's never enough resources. So just the nature of the environment of campaigns is much different than kind of corporate communications. I mean, corporate communications, their favorite thing is no comment. You know, I mean, I want to grow up and work for a big corporation and just say no comment. But if you're in the campaign world, you can't say no comment. In fact, you have to say all kinds of stuff. So even though they're both communications, the environment is super important. That's why that e-stock model, like what is the environment? Like what is the event? Like what's the context of this communication is super important.
And that's interesting, right? Because you make a very good point, right? So a company can duck an issue, providing it's not relevant to what they do. Whereas no, a politician,
like, I guarantee you, yeah, over the next few weeks, Tristan, you're going to read like the FT or DW and you're going to see like an article and like the company said no comment, you know, like no, like number 10 couldn't get up today and be like, no, they could do it maybe one day, but they couldn't do it for like a whole year. You know what I mean?
And it's funny because you see that with, and we got it in the UK at the moment with various, you know, tax issues for government ministers, and it's kind of like, you know, not to talk about, we consider this a private matter, doesn't stick it, you know, if the story's going to fly, that's a pathetic excuse and no one's going to let you get away with that. A company goes, we have nothing to say on that. You're right.
Exactly. Now, one time, I mean, my rule too is, I was, you know, I'm always like trying to get people to go on record or talk or, I mean, because at a certain point, reporters don't want to talk to the spokesperson all the time. They want to talk to people that have real skin in the game or, you know, like the actual executive of the company. And, you know, I was making the pitch to this company, like, hey, it'd be really great if your boss talked to CNBC. And he said, well, no, really, that's why we pay you. Like, you know, we don't want to deal with this stuff. Like, our, you know, like we want a buffer between like what's happening. To your point about the dark arts, like companies want stuff that are said out the idea in the market, ideas in the marketplace. And so maybe they'll fund a think tank, maybe they'll fund a professor, a research report, where this idea is kind of populated out there, but their hands aren't on it. That's part of quote unquote, the dark arts, right? It's just like, but a lot of times companies, since they have a longer time horizon and they don't have to, you know, they can say no comment or, oh, by the way, that's your job, Mark. You got to talk to the reporter.
And given one of the Human Risk podcast, one of the things that we've seen, I mean, it's been around, yeah, so celebrity endorsements has been an issue for some time, but we've seen recently, if I take Kanye West and Adidas as a good example,
yeah,
there was a time, I think, where you sort of hire celebs to make your product look good, sexy, interesting, attractive, whatever. And clearly nowadays it's big business in terms of the amounts of money that are spent. And you have people whose original job, whether that was, you know, David Beckham, be a really good example, makes a ton more money and has made a ton more money out of being a personality than ever out of his playing days. But he obviously had to play to be able to get to that position. But that's a sort of double-edged sword now. And so I wondered your reflections on that sort of use of endorsers, influencers, kind of that sort of thing. I mean, has it got trickier? It seems to me it's a higher risk thing now.
Well, I think it gets back to like the Adidas, Adidas, Kanye West. I mean, Kanye is a bit of a high wire act, right? I mean, so the Adidas knew maybe might not work out well. Like, Kanye is not a Roger Federer, right? Like a Roger Federer seems to be a great spokesperson. So I think that it seems like there was a bit of a risk there going in. I'm not sure that you know, Nike is awesome. And I think the people they've associated with have been quite successful, right? You know, and so I don't think it's completely discounted. I look at a more, that seemed like a desperate play by Adidas, you know, kind of like shake it up or kind of go a different direction. And they, I don't know, it'd be interesting to get the backstory on that if they, you know, thought this was a wild bet. But, you know, like a guy like Roger Federer or what Beckham's doing, you know, for the UAE seems, you know, pretty copacetic. But that's part of it too. Like they've, there's influencers that are playing like a long game versus a short game. Like to me, Kanye is a bit of a day trader by instinct, like the stuff he kind of does, like in terms of getting attention. Yeah. Whereas like a Roger Federer seems very sober long-term. And I think that's part of it too. I think there are times when as a communication, but that, you know, you got to go into it and be like, listen, what are we trying to, are we trying to just win like this quarter, this month? Like, are we going to day trade attention? That's pretty easy to do. I mean, you and me could get, you know, huge TikTok accounts and YouTube. Like we started doing crazy stuff and broadcasting it. That's pretty easy to do to get attention. But is it sustainable? Can you keep it going? Is it play into like the long-term situation? And I would guess that the conversations at Adidas, I mean, they, you know, you don't make that kind of a bet without talking to four or five other folks. And whatever reason, they thought Kanye was going to go and he made a good presentation, but they're definitely regretting it. But I think it'd be interesting to see who Adidas works with next. It's a more sober kind of person. But like I said, like a Roger Federer, I don't think any one of us would have a problem working with Roger.
Right. And so I guess you'd look at it as a sort of price that in, right? And so you'd go, it's only worth going with someone that's volatile, that, you know, with where actually I think I'm going to get short term. So I'd have to look at, and what I find interesting about that is they've obviously got a long established brand, right? This isn't a sort of upstart in that space. And so they've kind of gone, okay, we're gonna go with that. So based on what you're saying, obviously you're not privy to what happened, but it would seem like it's a calculated gamble. Or ought to be a calculated gamble if you go into that. And so you're looking very carefully around that celebrity. I guess it's a sort of downside play, right? Is you can sort of say it's easy to see the upside of being associated with these people. You also have to recognize they're human and they might do something that you don't like. And so you've got to mitigate that risk either by not going with people that might go massively off the reservation, or you price that in, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think like getting back to, I know I've harped on this a few times, but like in politics, like on campaigns, you're presented with all kinds of opportunities to have influencers or surrogates or speakers, or because you're trying to build this coalition. You're like, how do I get to that 50% plus one? What groups do I need to get involved? So there's plenty of opportunities to work with weird and interesting people, right? But is that just going to help us win this election as a short term? Like, what's it going to do to us long term? Where do you want to go? And I think what's been interesting with, especially like a Trumpster, I mean, Trump is like the ultimate, you know, day trader, right? Like he does not think long-term at all. He's just like, I need to win this news cycle. I'm going to do this. Like, you know, he's just the exact opposite of like thinking 20, 30 years, where it's like, and Obama is like, I'm thinking legacy, I'm thinking long-term. Tony Blair versus Boris Johnson, right? Same, you know, like Boris is just like, how do I win this? How do I get attention? How do I wear the high vis jacket today? And I think that comes down to like personality and who you're surrounded with too. You know, like who's your staffer, who's advising you, and what is the business model of that kind of politician or that kind of company? The Adidas, yeah, it's interesting, the influencers, because you want to, like, there's just something about, like, I don't know, like being associated with certain people, but it does seem sometimes very short circuit. And very high wire act.
Yeah, because I mean, it struck me that there are certain, I don't know, if you like the music industry, it is not unhelpful to have rock stars throwing TVs out of window, doing crazy stuff, because you're, and that's that's entirely on brand, right? But if you were somebody that was a sort of had a more family audience, you're not going to want, there's a different thing there. And so for me, it's sort of fascinating to look at it and say, it's back to your point. It's like, who are you? What's your game here? What's your business? What works for you? And you have to think this thing through. And so again, that brings us back to what you do, right? Which is thinking through what's the message you want to get across and how does this play?
Yeah. I mean, I think about Apple, right? So Apple now is like about fear and safety. Like, oh, you know, like you've got your watch, like it'll tell you you're going to die in a car crash. Whereas like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was like, oh, the rebels, the freaks, you know, like we're tearing down the big guy. Like, you know, now it was more rebellious. Now it's much more, let's wrap ourselves up in plastic. The world is scary. That's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. And that has more to do with like where they are and their business models. And I think a lot about like, I'm really fascinated by sports and the influence they have on society. And I think about like F1, right? I mean, these F1 drivers all look fantastic. You know, I've never seen an ugly F1 driver, right? Now to me, and I'm sure there's been a few, you know, ugly F1 drivers, but that whole business model is like sex, you know, daredevil, speed, keep the money coming, sponsorships, Monaco, right? So, you know, you're never going to see a ginormous fat, you know, F1 driver, because that doesn't play into the business model of like what they're trying to accomplish, right? Whereas like, yeah, a wrestler or a rock and roll star, like there's part of like it, the environment, like demands that you act in a certain way. F1 drivers are, F1 is like, the whole thing is like a giant circus, right? I mean, it's just like drama and, you know, sex, Monaco, it's great.
Speaking of which, right, I can't let you go, Mark, without talking about the podcast that you recently launched with someone that's been on the show before, a mutual friend of ours, Gerald Ashley. So tell people a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I met Joe. I've never actually met him in person, which is great. I've never seen him face-to-face. I've only seen him technology-wise. We connected over Twitter, and we just have been having these conversations about just what's happening in the world, and it's been fun. I mean, you know, we've been trying to go around the world, kind of capture. It's been a very exciting year. We launched, I think, almost a year ago. We've done, I think, 20 different pods and just try a quick rundown of what's happening in the world and where it's going and what we think might happen. And the world has gotten much more real, which is exciting. You know, I think, it's exciting for me. It's like a strategist, but it's gotten much more sober and much more serious. And I think having talked to people, especially with different perspectives and different skill sets from different parts of the world, is helpful. Not only to learn like what's happening and to hear different perspectives. So yeah, Gerald's been a great comedic partner. We've been trying to get a radio deal with RAI, I tell you, but they've yet to reach out to us.
It's only a matter of time, and I really want to flag that up, and I'll put links to that and to all the other things you do in the show notes, Mark, because it's one of those pods that I just love listening to, because you both, it's a labor of love, right? You have fun doing it. And it's always done with a sort of wry smile, and it's a sort of cynical, amused view of the world. But I love listening to it because I always learn something. And I think you are a great, in the nicest possible way, great comic duo as well. So that comes thoroughly recommended.
No, I appreciate saying that. Our production team of zero is, with the amount of prep we put into it. But I think that's good. Sometimes, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of great pods. And I think sometimes you just want to have a conversation. This format is really interesting because I think we're hardwired as humans to like listen to stories. And it's so instant because it comes into your head.
Right.
It's kind of a cool format.
Well, A lot of people I'm told listen to this show while they're doing runs and walks and things like that. And I like that because that feels like a sort of captive audience on the basis if you're running, you're unlikely to be able to chase the track.
No, I love it. That's good.
So anybody who is listening to this while running, thank you so much for sticking with us. And on that note, Mark, anything else I should have asked you, given you want to make sure that you communicate yourself properly?
No, this was great. I appreciate reaching out. I'm a huge fan of your work. You as a entrepreneur, like your look and feel, the imagery, it's time for you to do a masterclass. You've done some, I mean, really intuitive, very fun stuff, which I think is a credit to you. I mean, you put a lot of thought, very intentional, and you're ready to be a communication strategist.
Far too kind. And with comments like that, Mark Ross, you can come back on the show anytime you like. But I
love it. Maybe next time we can meet in a train station somewhere in Europe. Those have been my favorite.
I would love that.
Those have been my favorite experiences when you post about your train travel across Europe. It's great.
Well, we can do a secret briefcase handover on a platform somewhere and ask each other, wear funny hats and sunglasses and speak code words to each other on a platform and then go for a beer afterwards is the most important thing.
I love it.
But
I'd hate to pain you to come over to the US and take the Acela. But you know, maybe I'll trick you once that we can take the Acela train up to New York City.
It's a journey I've done. I've done it a couple of times, actually. It was better than I was expecting.
There you go. It's like time traveling the opposite direction there.
Exactly. Mark, listen, firstly, thank you. Your social media content is great. I always enjoy it. There's always something interesting there. And as people will have detected on the show, you've got a tremendous amount to offer. So thank you for spending the time to share it with me and my listeners. It's been fun. It's been informative and I've loved it. So thank you very much.
Fantastic. Wonderful to be here. Thanks, Christian. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon, buddy.
So that's it for this episode of the Human Risk Podcast. My enormous thanks to Mark for appearing and to you for listening. To find out more about Mark, his work as a communication strategist, and the podcast that we talked about with his friend and former guest on this show, Gerald Ashley, there are links to those in the show notes. If this is your first time listening to the Human Risk Podcast, welcome. You can subscribe wherever you get your quality audio content. It's available on all of the major podcasting platforms. Your usual reminder that you can pre-order my book, Humanizing Rules, Bringing Behavioral Science to Ethics and Compliance, and there's a link to that in the show notes as well. To catch up on previous episodes of the show that you might have missed, have a look at humanriskpodcast.com. You'll find links to those there. I'll be back very soon with another episode of this show. But in the meantime, good luck with your comms, stay safe, and thank you so much for listening.